Now, in recessionary Dublin, where youthful individuality was often curbed by the establishment, expression was found through the music of bands like U2, the Boomtown Rats, the Virgin Prunes. Crikey! That does be the blurb on the back of Where the Streets Have Two Names, a new book about the Dublin music scene of 1978 to 1981, and the early days, of course, of U2. The book is a collection of photographs, an awful lot of them previously unpublished, which captures all the rebellious and exuberant history and music lore, of course, as well, of that era. The man who took all those photos and is responsible for putting the book together is Patrick Brocklebank, and he joins me now in the studio alongside Ferdy McKenna, whose face pops up several times in the pages of this book as his alter ego, Rocky De Valera. Together they will now look back at this golden age for the Dublin music scene as I put the kettle on. Boys, where do we start? First of all, you, the title of the book, Patrick, yeah. Why did you choose that title, Where the Streets Have Two Names?
Well, it is naturally the first thing that springs to mind is the song by U2, The Streets Have No Names. Dublin has two names, Oscarga, Osos, Berla,
oh, yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
And that was really the inspiration from it. And because I was wanted to do a book not just about the music scene, but because of Dublin and Dublin City. And that's really the inspiration for that.
Okay, and you were what age around that time? The right age to be punk, or too old to be a hippie?
I would have been... I was young enough to be a punk.
Young enough to be a punk. And were you a punk?
Well, sort of, perhaps.
Like a participant or an observer?
Well, I suppose both, really. I was really into the scene. I mean, Carol from the Boy Scouts one time said to me in McGonagall's late night, you know, it's nice to see somebody who's really into the business and not just doing it for the money. Well, I can tell you one thing, I did cover my expenses, but money, making money, it's another matter.
Okay, Ferdy, just thinking about you and all that time, and I think about it like, it's not as though every band was a punk band or anything like that, or even a new wave band. You were over the whole scene as a different kind of band. In the same way as Thin Lizzy went through and were accepted by all of that new wave and punky kind of stuff and people in the late 1970s, and yet you think they wouldn't be because they were playing good old-fashioned rock and roll with twin guitars from years ago, you were an observer to the whole thing in some ways, and yet you were right in the middle of it. You certainly weren't a punk band.
No, we weren't, but we came out of that punk energy. A lot of that, like Dr. Feelgood weren't a punk band, but they were totally accepted. So it was R&B and punk, the Sex Pistols, it wasn't that different from 3-minute guitar songs. And a lot of the energy in the bands, the difference was in punk, suddenly everyone could do it. You could plug in, and if you only knew 3 chords, that was all you needed. It's like Lou Reed said once, you just need 1 chord, you know, 2 chords is better. 3 chords, you're into jazz. You know, it was a bit like that. Everybody could form a band, everyone could dream. And I met Patrick early days because I was a rock critic first, like yourself and like a lot of people in the scene. The way to get into music was to write about it, and you get free records and you get to listen to them. But Patrick was my first ever assignment as a rock critic. Patrick was assigned to me as my photographer, and we were going into McGonagall's. I think we were to shoot Berlin, and Patrick had no camera. And I said, you're my photographer and you've no camera, what are you going to do? And he says, I'll meet someone at the gig and I'll borrow a camera. And he did, and it was fine, and the photographs appeared. And then we did a lot of gigs together for about a year, didn't we?
Yeah.
And the thing about this book is that...
You were assigned a photographer?
I was assigned a photographer by Dublin Magazine, Patrick Bracco. You asked me, was Patrick a punk? Or yes, Patrick was Patrick a punk. Patrick was Patrick. He was beyond punk. He was beyond new wave. He was music. He was definitely into music.
Punk wouldn't have allowed him in.
And the reason people liked Patrick shooting him was that he was there for the right reasons. He was there because, and a lot of the photographs in this book are instant photographs captured in only like when the band were on stage, when the band were off stage, and they're at odd angles, they're absolutely clear lines, straightforward lines. There's very few posed photographs in the book, is all the better for it.
Yeah.
Or at least they don't seem very posed to me.
And when they are posed,
they're hilarious. They're like the new versions, or bands like the Skank Mooks. Do you remember the Skank Mooks?
Of course I remember the
legendary
Skank
Dublin
Mooks.
Band. And even, you know, the on stage shots. I have to say that the black and white photography is incredibly evocative, and it's beautiful. There's a photograph of McGonagall's that I recognise 3 people in the queue. I don't even know their names, but everybody in that landscape was captured in this book. It wasn't just about the bands, it was about the people who followed the bands, who then became bands. So the difference between punk and everything else was suddenly it was do-it-yourself. Everybody could do it. If you wanted to be on stage, you could be.
So whatever was happening in London in 76, 77, we came a little bit later, 77, 78, 79. Listen, just on that, before I go back to you, Patrick, just on the whole subject of punk, to whatever that might mean to somebody listening now, wasn't a clue. Where do you think punk drew its influences from? Or was it trying to just exist in its own thing?
Well, to me, the first I came up was Blondie, Ramones, Iggy, The Stooges, that sort of high-volume, 3-minute poppy rock songs.
In other words, totally New York 76.
New York 76. They were called the Blank Generation for once. Richard Hell and Richard the Voidoids, Hell. All those. That was where I got into it. And then suddenly there were the Radiators from Space were here and they were our own homegrown punks. And I often think that people took Lynott as a punk as well because he was an outsider. He came out, you know, he came up the hard way and he was in this rock band and he was writing about Dublin, expressing a particular point of view. I don't think he was a million miles removed from the punk idea. And also the punk thing got away from musos. This business that you had to really know how to play guitar solos for 20 minutes or be Emerson, Lake and Palmer or Yes. The punk thing was about instant and also it was commentary. Commentary, I mean, I remember various of those bands like The Pretty and those kind of, even the Skangmooks, a lot of their songs were commentary on what they saw around them in Dublin, which was unemployed, depressed, it was beginning to be druggy, it was beginning to be kind of the recession. We knew nothing else except recession in those days. But I think that they were social commentary. And also, it was the beginning of that youth thing where you had a place to go, Dandelion Green, the gigs there, McGonagall's, South Ann Street, the Coffee Inn. Yeah. All of those places grew up. The Bailey, if you wanted to pose. Larry Tobin's, if you wanted to hang out with people.
Yeah.
McGonagall's Late Night, if you were really langered and you wanted to score. You know, or McGonagall's, the carpet moved in McGonagall's and spoke back to you. They were dives, but they were... The adults didn't go there, if you like.
Absolutely.
It was the new generation.
When you mentioned in Dublin magazine, I was doing it for about a year and a half, then you came in, and then I was DJ McGonagall's all the time, and I do remember you, Patrick, around a lot. So let's just take a look at this, Patrick. What was it for you between 78 and 81 that was so important? Were you more interested in some side of it, like capturing it, looking at the fashion and the vibes of it? In other words, the cue was as important as the band, or was it the music for you? What was it?
Well, every matter of it, I was... very, very interested in punk rock music. I remember the Sex Pistols' first album. I thought it was absolutely amazing. And then, as I say, the Irish bands had to react in some ways and thus formed the bands like the Radiators and U2 and so on. It was everything.
What was your first gig with a camera?
My first gig with a camera was Boomtown Rats, 11th of June, 1978.
Was it the Olympia?
It was indeed, yes. And I really wasn't sure what I was doing insofar as, you know, I was way, way over my depth.
So you were the same as punk. Like, you hadn't a bloody clue in some ways. Like, most of the bands in punk, two chords maybe, it was completely DIY.
Yeah.
Completely the opposite of what, say, Rod Stewart playing to 50,000 people or, you know, whoever it happened to be, Elton John, etc. The whole thing was a reaction against an awful lot of that. And you were doing the same thing with a camera.
I was, yes.
Few gigs, you forgot to bring the damn camera.
I didn't really know how to use the camera. I swear to God, I didn't. The photographs of the Boomtown Rats taken from the balcony there. It was a learning curve for me. It's a wonder they even turned out. But I still think it is an important photograph for me. And
okay, so that's just one that you did. But Johnny Fingers from the band, the keyboard player, asked you to go again because he was managing a band called Berlin.
Yes.
And did it kind of take off because
of
that kind
brother,
of thing?
His brother, Patrick Moylis, came up to us at the end of the night, myself and my brother, and asked him, listen, are you, do you want to come along to this gig? About a week, 10 days or so later in McGonagall's. And that was, I had learned a little bit more about photography by 10 days, a week or so later. And I actually made a slight better success of it. And as you can see, that was resulting in my first ever published photograph of Brian Fries in McGonagall's.
Right.
And I got five of it.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking about Where the Streets Have Two Names, the book that's out at the moment from Patrick Brocklebank. Almost entirely, really, it's a pictorial view of 78 to 81 in Dublin in terms of the music scene. But there's obviously the script and all the rest as well. Just Patrick, on that one there, just in terms of that, the important events of the Dublin music scene 78 to 81, the record stores, they were important to you as well. What were they?
They were really hangout places.
Yeah,
like especially,
what I mean.
Especially Advance Records, Murray's Records, George Murray. I mean, George Purdy, who now lives in Australia, he told me one time, I heard the first ever U2 demo in George Murray's record centre because Bono went into George Murray, hey, listen, you know, I got this really first demo. He played it, you know, and George was able to play it out on the street, and people in the actual arcade as well heard this, and it caused a little bit of a stir at the time. But yeah, it was certainly was a drop-in point.
Okay, and you then, Ferdia, in terms of Rocky De Valera, etc. I mean, the Dandelion, the Olympia, the Olympic Ballroom, Dailyman Park, McGonagall's, Moran's, Zero's, Rock Palace, Project
Toners,
Top Hat, Toners, of course, Black Rock Park with stuff that myself and Wilson put on, etc.
Yeah.
Dingo's, Rock Palace, Bag It In, Toner, Stardust, The Bailey, The Magnet. You were around all of those.
I was at all of those places, and I saw many of the gigs that Patrick took photographs of in that era. The extraordinary thing about it is that if you were there, if you lived through that era, those photographs are absolutely it. They totally capture it. And if you've heard about Dark Space, if you've heard about McGonagall's, if you've heard about the Atrix, if you've heard about the Early Blades,
you know, Dark Space
is
the 24-hour thing that was on the project. And I had to review the gig of U2 for Hot Press at the time. And there was about literally 8 people watching it. They came on at 2 o'clock in the morning. Death Race 2000. They were showing in the other room and there were 40 times as many people looking at that.
It was extraordinary. I remember John Peel reviewed us. We played a gig and we had Jack Dublin on bass, and John Peel said, Rocky De Valera and the Gravediggers think they're a rock and roll rockabilly band, but they're a rather good R&B band, and it's good to see that the bass player is the same age as myself. Jack Dublin was 17 at the time, and John Peel was about late 30s, you know, so
did he look a bit older?
He must have been in his 23rd hour, I would say, at that stage. I think, you know, the thing about this book is there's a couple of great heroes from that era that weren't chronicled, you know. The Atrix, John Barman. And I can remember the first time I heard The Moon Is Puce and Treasure in the Wasteland.
Those Treasure in the Wasteland was the one.
And I sometimes do DJs with vinyl records, and I'm always asked for The Moon Is Puce, even today. So there's a kind of a subcult around them. They're an absolutely wonderful band. DC9, I can remember the effect they had when they came out first.
They turned into Tokyo Olympics.
They turned into Tokyo Olympics, but there was something about DC9 that was... They just had it for a moment,
Paul
and the moment
McGuinness
passed.
Was the guy's name, but it's a different Paul McGuinness.
Yeah,
just the media then. Like, we've got this book here now to look back, and we can all sit in our rocking chairs and say how great the time was. But what about the media at the time? Did we want the media to reflect the real honesty of what was there, or were we better off having outraged photographs at the front of the evening papers or the morning papers and saying, yeah, the more they don't like this whole generation, the better it is for this generation?
Well, I'm glad they missed it, because they gave us freedom. They gave us freedom, and the things that were important turned up in Dublin Magazine and the caption reviews and in the articles.
And Hot Press, and
you know, other little things. The fanzine started up. There was a scene around Trinity, and you could block out your days, you could block out your weekends, but where you could go, and you never arranged to meet people. There were no mobile phones. There was not even a cappuccino to be had. Yes. So it was a different era and a very free era, and people didn't know what you're up. It was we could create our own scenes. Dandelion Green, for instance, the bands got the gig if they built the stage. You know, John Fishy ran gigs with Owen O'Shea, and he turned up early. You can keep all the money in the door, but you had to build the stage with him.
Exactly.
And my first job was selling punk rock badges in the Dandelion Green. And there's a photograph in Patrick's book of, I think, my elbow and the badges and John Fisher's neck. And you can see the badges, and there's a little Rocky De Valera badge in the middle of it all, plus the Atrix, plus all of the Irish bands who are forging their own identities.
Listen, there's two or three at least photographs of me in the book. I don't remember one, but I don't even remember.
Really? You don't remember the ones I took in a studio somewhere here?
I can't remember.
It was about 2 weeks after the rock show started up.
In here at 2FM, in Radio 2, really. Yeah. And there was pirate stuff, of course, before that. There was a few of those in here too.
The pirates and then 2FM, that was another extraordinary time. Just suddenly that you could have access to the airwaves in a different way. You know, that suddenly this music wasn't regulated. It just appeared and could still go on. There's yourself, there was Pat James. Yeah. There was a whole bunch of these people who came along and came through the airwaves and preserved the kind of...
You're talking Dublin.
Yeah,
Dublin. Now, let's just take a look for a second. Did punk exist in rural Ireland? I'm not even talking Limerick, Galway, Cork. I'm talking about anywhere else. Like, was it just a...
Nunataks, absolutely stunning band. And we lost the singer who was an amazing
very
character.
Early on,
they were brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant. And who's similar, I remember Hot Guitars and Nunataks, I remember at the same kind of R&B band plus kind of punky band. And I actually remember when I was a researcher here, I put the Nunataks on a show where they were singing a song about Red Cortina, and we hired a Red Cortina and they destroyed it. Made for a great video, but I don't think the owner of the Red Cortina was very pleased. There was some kind of wonderful. There were loads of bands. There was Zebra.
Just with all of that, let's get to the U2 bit of that, because there are pictures in here of U2 in the early days that have never been around before. U2 at the Project, U2 supporting the Strangers of Dunleary, at the Opera's Christmas Party, the Greedy Bastards with McGonagall's, Dark Space as the one I mentioned, the Buttery, Trinity College again, the Dandelion, Gowrie Arts Festival. You weren't necessarily following them around, it was just you were following the scene, weren't you, really?
Well, yeah, I thought probably they were the best band on the scene. And Niall Stokes used to think I had a fixation with the Ramones, believe it or not. And he said, I think that probably the band most likely to succeed on the scene at the moment is U2, because they got Paul McGuinness managing them, and he's very, very good. He's very organised, and the band, I think, that are the most organised are the most likely to make it onto Top of the Pops and be as big as Sham 69, maybe.
Listen, I was just stunned when somebody told me they might play the stadium. I was going, don't be ridiculous. Yeah. You two aren't going to
Well, they were serious. A lot of us were serious to a degree, but and they were fun on stage, but they were very serious about how they took their music and what they did with their careers.
Yeah.
And they saw rock and roll as a career, I think, you know, and I don't mean that in any derogatory way. I think they did it the right way. I think the rest of us lived the moment and lived it magnificently sometimes and lived it disastrously.
And was it almost an entirely youth-driven culture, the whole punk thing, the whole scene? I mean, a lot of those bands around there.
It didn't last long. That's the extraordinary thing. It was 77, 70, early 79, and it kind of burned out, became New Wave, became Gotti, and all the other things.
Yeah.
But it was tribal. I mean, for the first time, besides boot boys and skinheads and hippies, there were other cultures. There were punks and there were...
But what about the mentality then? Like, you know, hippies, mods, what made it different?
It was... competitive. The tribes didn't get on always. Yeah. There were certain bands that were latched onto by certain tribes, and there were kind of scuffles and things. The weird thing about it is it seemed to happen underground. It seemed to happen... I remember being at a gig since it's by the Outcasts from Belfast, and it was a lunchtime gig in McGonagall's.
I remember,
and
there was a row. Over you.
And the three of them jumped off the stage and beat up the audience, and the audience loved it because they were so out of town. I remember seeing the Revillos in Liberty Hall at that gig, and Faye Five knocked out a guy from the audience with a punch, and the audience gave them three encores. So it was a different era. But to answer it, I think it was an explosion of youth culture and an explosion of colour.
Yeah, can I just say though, like, I mean, I was the DJ at McGonagall's for all those gigs that were happening with the tree in the middle of the stage. I mean, there was a tree in the middle of the bleeding stage. It was ridiculous. But the funny thing is, like, is an awful lot of the other people that came in and played, like Mike Absalom or Otway and Barrett and that, who weren't punk and that, they really added something to, like, there's more
Otway
to...
Otway and Barrett, absolutely.
I'm afraid I missed those.
Oh, Otway and Barrett were fantastic.
I missed them.
Especially when they did headbutts on stage.
He was banging his head off the tree for about an hour. It was fantastic. Best headbutting person I've ever seen. All right, so Patrick, the book itself then. Some of the most important photographs in terms of just the iconography of the time can't be bet, besides these ones that you've got, is just at parties and things.
Yes.
You went to U2 houses.
I did, actually. I actually... used to stay in their own brothers had rented a house in a housing estate called the Willows, just on the Finglas Road there, and I used to stay there over that period. And when I'd finish my shift at either Hot Preston in Dublin, I'd bump into them at, say, McGonagall's or outside or whatever, and said, "Listen, come back and stay." So we used to go back there, and, you know, we'd talk about all sorts of stuff and play records and listen to Big D, actually,
of course,
and demo tapes. Yeah. And but yes, I was almost. I wasn't a member of Lipton Village, but I was almost a de facto member of Lipton Village.
What did that mean to you when people talk about Lipton Village in the early days of U2?
Lipton Village was like a clique of people, a little social group revolving about U2 and the Virgin Prunes and their friends and so on.
Okay, just the one thing about the punk thing before we just take a look at it finally is the fact that, like, a lot of people said that punk in England was Dole Q stuff and a reaction against nobody getting a job and not being able to get one, etc. That in America it was all to do with skinny ties, and to be honest, it was just a fast music thing of new stuff coming out of New York in 76 maybe. Yeah. What, was it anything different in Ireland, or was it just a little bit of all of that?
It was a bit of all that, but as I said to you before, the big thing about punk was do it yourself. You know, you want to be on stage, you can form a band. You want to have an artistic voice, do it. You want to plug in a guitar, play it. You only need one chord, one string, one voice, one song, one tune, whatever it is. And people did. And it was fantastic. I do remember at one stage, though, I reviewed 3 weeks in a row for In Dublin, and there were three different Irish punk bands, and each of them had a song called Society. And I remember that was particular, and the chorus
the
was...
we've been looking for the last 20 minutes. Brilliant. Really? That's very good.
Good. They were all good, but the song sounded a bit samey. Yeah, but I think it was a short-lived thing. You know, its influence was phenomenal. And the other thing I associate that with was a look. You know, No Romance was the first clothes shop that sold specifically punky or new wave clothes to people in Ireland. But, and also, you made up your own clothes. Yeah. You did your own thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Binliners, for God's sake.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, look, family, Catholic Church, conservative Ireland. Did punk create certain tensions and all of that kind of thing?
Well, we just ignored those things the way they're ignored today. We were just ahead of the time, you know. When you think of how huge they were, you think of how important they were, they didn't exist to a large degree in this in the world I moved in.
All right, well, listen, you can see it all exist in the book. The book is called Where the Streets Have Two Names. Ferdy McGann has been here. By the way, Rocky De Valera has been
and
back.
And the Rhythm Kings. Yeah, we're back, yeah.
The compilation here, as well as everything else.
Yeah, we had the best of. We reformed in April and we're playing gigs. We've played about 10 gigs so far, which is like a world tour for us.
Really?
Yeah, we have. I'll keep you posted next time and give you a shout. But we've got all our old songs from vinyl and we got them remastered by Fred Meyer, who was a famous guru in the music scene, put them out ourselves on CD and sold out. We printed 350 copies of the CD out. There's still a few left in Tower Records and Freeburg, but it was a great thing to do when we were all reunited. We're all still alive, and so we're all playing.
Right, very good. And above ground, what about you, Patrick, and the book itself? I mean, not just, first of all, it's called Where the Streets Have Two Names. It sells for what? What's the public?
The hardback is a little over 26 or thereabouts.
Right. Hardback with the
full. I just want to say, I think it's an absolutely brilliant book. Yeah. Can I just say that because it makes you feel like you were there, and if you're too young to remember what it was like, you will see it and you'll remember it.
Right, okay. So is that going anywhere else around the world? Is
it? I believe it's due for release in the United States in June.
Very good. Yeah. Okay, listen, Patrick, thanks a million for dropping in. Patrick Brocklebank. Where the Streets Have Two Names is the name of the book. Ferdy McGann here as well. Thank you, guys. Let's play this.